case, right? Normally, these sort of situations are reserved for, I don't want to say reserved, but typically what happens is, you know, you have grandma or your mother or your father who is kind of lost, you know, for whatever reason has had dementia, and they've, or maybe, you know, Alzheimer's, and they're, you know, they're not all there mentally, right? So Brittany has been challenging this conservatorship for years, and we finally have a pretty substantial development, at least I think, and I'll tell you why. So I'll read you a little bit from this story from NBC News to give you the, you know, the update here on where we are at this point. So, Los Angeles. Britney Spears was granted a request to hire her own attorney on Wednesday. That would have been yesterday. A development that could mark a major shift in how her 13-year conservatorship case has been handled. The scheduled court hearing was forced to address the sudden departure of her court-appointed attorney, Samuel D. Ingram III, who has handled her case since 2008. L.A. County Superior Court Judge Brenda Penny approved Ingram's resignation and his replacement with Britney Spears' chosen attorney, former federal prosecutor Matthew Rosengart. Story goes on to say Britney Spears broke down crying. She's, you know, going through more background. She's had issues with her father. I know there was another interesting tidbit in this article I wanted to get to. Hold on one second. Yeah, so that's about it. Yeah, so where are we now? So Britney had a court-appointed attorney back in 08 when this guardianship arrangement initially came down. The fact that it's been going on for the past 12 or 13 years, and I don't want to speculate because I don't know too much about the details of this case, but you know, I would think that she's probably wasn't being well served by that court-appointed attorney for the fact that she's been under the situation for 13 years. Then again, maybe she really is, you know, just incapable of taking care of herself, and that's why this has gone on so long. But now she has the opportunity to hire her own counsel, which I think will definitely help her out in the long run because, you know, typically, you know, look, if you're going to be spending, you know, more on a lawyer, you would hope that the quality of the representation would be a lot better. So, yeah, we wish Brittany the best. I thought that this would be an interesting update to bring to everybody, considering we've been talking about this story for the past few weeks. And we'll keep following it, of course. But, yeah, so let's hope Brittany can, you know, have this lawyer give her better representation and that she can, you know, get out of this conservatorship arrangement. Because if it's really the case that, you know, her father's abusing his position and, you know, stealing from her, I guess it would be part of that, you know, that should end, right? It's not right under any situation, whether or not, you know, I mean, think about your grandma, your son, or your, I don't know, even your brother falling to get victim in one of these cases, right? It's not fair that, you know, somebody else gets to profit out the fruits of your labor when they really have no right to. So, all right, that's it for Brittany. In other celebrity news, I'm going to update you on another story that we talked about on this program before, and that has to do with John McAfee, the infamous antivirus software magnate, right? So a few weeks back, God, I think it must have been 3 weeks at this point, right? 2 or 3 weeks, John McAfee was found dead in a Spanish jail, right? And this was about a matter of hours, I think, after the Spanish court approved his extradition to the United States to face trial on a variety of charges, mostly stemming from alleged tax fraud and a crypto pump and dump scheme, right? So I wish I had the tweet up in front of me right now because it was really funny, but I know John had, well, Mr. McAfee, let's call him that. I don't know him too personally, but you know, Mr. McAfee, I believe he put out a tweet or made some kind of statement years ago where he basically admitted to not paying taxes for the past like 12 or 15 years, something crazy like that. So the IRS had his number, right? You don't mess with the IRS, folks. I mean, I don't have to tell any of you that, but I think you understand. You know, that's how they ultimately got, God, I always forget his name, the mobster from the 1920s in Chicago. Al Capone, right? Al Capone, you know, was probably responsible for the deaths of tens, if not hundreds of people, you know, allegedly. And ultimately what ended up, you know, putting him in Alcatraz for a while was the fact that he had, you know, the IRS went after him for tax fraud because he wasn't reporting all the income earned off of the illegal businesses. So just an interesting side note. Somebody had told me that, and, you know, I'm not a tax lawyer, so don't quote me on this, but even the IRS, like, gives you an opportunity to report income that you got from illegal sources, right? So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people would be hesitant. If that's the case, you know, I think a lot of people would be hesitant to write that down and admit to it. But if that is true, that's pretty funny that the IRS doesn't Look, they don't care where you're getting the money. They just want their cut of it, you know?
Well, I guess, you know, we can speculate on who the real mobsters are at the end of the day here. But let's get back to John, right? So John, you know, was found, John McAfee, of course, was found dead in the Spanish jail cell. I already went over this. But, you know, he, and by other background, he had apparently put out some tweets saying that he had some information that was compromising on the CIA and other global elites. And he put out another tweet last year where he said something along the lines of, you know, if you find me dead, a la Epstein, you know, hinting to the fact that, well, I guess the allegation that Mr. Jeffrey Epstein, the infamous you know, sex trafficking billionaire, was found dead in a U.S. jail cell. And, you know, under very suspicious circumstances. That's a whole nother, that's a whole story for another show. Yeah, so they found John dead in the cell. And everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people were, you know, very skeptical over the idea that he, you know, he himself took his own life, you know, considering, you know, what I just laid out, that he had allegedly had this compromising information on all these intelligence agencies, and that he even, himself even said that, hey, I'm not gonna off myself in prison, folks. You know? Very, very bizarre. So the new wrinkle to this story is that his late wife, Janice McAfee, has released the apparent suicide note, right? Now, I took a look at it. There's a story on the, you know, from the New York Post. You can go check it out online. Headline is, John McAfee's widow releases suicide note. She believes it's fake. I guess I kind of gave away the end of the story there. But yeah, so she posted or released the picture of this the suicide note, right? And I'm looking at it right now, and it's really bizarre. A lot of words are scratched out. I'll do my best to interpret it for you. Then I'll read from the beginning. I am a phantom parasite. The present moments, I use it to attain my own ends instead of fully living it. I want to control my future, which does not exist. Which more mere ashes of memory. I'm sorry, folks. This is brutally hard to read because there's a lot of scribbles. Go check out the New York Post story. You can see a picture of the note itself. So anyway, why this is important, right? Janice McAfee, you know, John's late wife, is alleging that this is a fake note. And for a variety of reasons, number one, she said that this seems more like somebody is, you know, I'm quoting her from the article here. Someone was trying to imitate John's style of tweeting, right? Like they were trying to write one of his tweets into a suicide note, allegedly. Right, so that's an interesting, I mean, who would know him better than his wife, right? So there's one wrinkle to it, but what really kind of, you know, draws me into the story and makes me a little bit more skeptical about the whole story, the whole, you know, narrative that he took his own life, is this other allegation she's saying that she was told by the autopsy official, or prison officials, I guess, that they found this note in John's pocket, right? So you would think, you know, a big, you know, it appears to be like a 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. You would expect that if it was found in, you know, John McAfee's pocket, it would be wrinkled. There'd be, you know, signs of, you know, stress to the page. And there's none of that. It just looks like, at least from what she posted and what she's, you know, Janice has claimed, this was just a plain, you know, other than the scribbles, a perfect condition piece of paper, right? So that's very bizarre. Why would they tell, you know, if that's true, that this is, you know, in a pristine, unfolded condition, why would they tell her that, oh, yeah, we found it in his pocket, right? Why not just say, oh, you know, we found it in his room? Very interesting. So, look, that's not enough to, you know, conclude that there was a conspiracy going on here. But, I mean, you know, it's an interesting wrinkle to the story. It certainly is. And, you know, I hope more and more information comes out. It's going to be very interesting to follow this as we move on. Speaking of which, you know, what's going on with Ghislaine Maxwell, right? That's Jeffrey Epstein's former, you know, associate, I guess, for lack of a more diplomatic term, right? She'd been arrested last year, or a couple years ago now, and we haven't really heard a whole lot about that. And that sort of brings us to our next story. This is a little more Jersey focused because it involves some New Jersey players. You know, piggybacking off this idea of, you know, government corruption and things that just don't make sense, suspicious quote-unquote suicides,
right? So I'll read you the headline from this next story from NJ.com. Congress asked to pass bill to protect judges in response to a deadly killing in New Jersey. Read you a little bit from the story here. Again, this is from NJ.com. Author Jonathan D. Salant. Shout out to him. Thanks for putting this together, bro. So, legislation was introduced Wednesday to protect members of the federal judiciary by keeping their personal information secret 7 months after the first effort to pass the bill was blocked on the Senate floor. Right? The legislation, called the Daniel Andrerl Judicial Security and Privacy Act, was named for U.S. District Court Judge Esther Salas' son, who was gunned down at their home in North Brunswick a year ago this month. The suspect at the time was alleged to have killed himself. So, looking at this from a 30,000-foot level, let's give you the background here. So, Judge Salas was apparently appointed as the judge in some sort of civil litigation, and I forget the ins and outs of this, but she was the judge presiding over this case dealing with money transactions, right? From what I understand, this case kind of focused on, I think it was shareholders, and don't quote me on this, but it was shareholders of some kind of bank, and they were basically questioning whether this bank had, this bank was doing business with Jeffrey Epstein. That's why this is where we get into the weird stuff, right? So this bank was allegedly doing all these deals with Epstein in, I believe, 2013 and 2014. And mind you, this was after he was not found, but pled guilty to a variety of, sex crimes, right? So how this case got spawned was, I guess, shareholders or other people who were involved with this company started asking questions like, hey, why are you doing business with this guy, right? He just got, a few years back, at this point in time, he had been, pleaded guilty to all these horrible, horrible things, right? So why are we, doing all these multi-million-dollar business deals with him, right? So Judge Salas was appointed to the case that ultimately spawned out of this questioning. And interestingly enough, last year, I guess about a year ago exactly, roughly, I guess, I remember this coming out. This was wild at the time. The story goes that somebody posed as a FedEx driver or some kind of delivery company driver and knocked on the door of Judge Salas's house. She was home along with her husband and her son. Her son and I think her husband answered the door, and whoever this person was, allegedly, who was dressed in this UPS or FedEx uniform, pulled out a gun and shot both the husband and the son. Unfortunately, the son passed, and send our thoughts and prayers out to the family, because even a year later, I'm sure that still hurts. I can't even imagine what it's like to lose a child in such a horrific fashion. And I know the husband did make it. I don't know what kind of injuries he sustained. If he's in better shape now, we hope he is, obviously. But anyway, so this, just based on the fact that this was a case that involved Epstein, you had big money interests involved. A lot of people started asking questions like, were they trying to threaten the judge here, right? Basically, maybe send a message, maybe take her off the case. Maybe she was the target of a hit. You could speculate until the end of time. I mean, ultimately, the official story goes that it was this guy. I don't even want to say his name, because if this is really him, he's a piece of scum and he doesn't deserve the recognition. But the allegation was that this individual was some sort of men's rights activist, and, argue whatever you want to argue. It's, your First Amendment right to, support whatever you want to support. So I can't go after him for that necessarily. But, the story goes that he had appeared before Judge Salas on multiple occasions before this had happened, as a lawyer. He was a lawyer too. And, had some kind of adversarial relationship with her ever since appearing before her, but that didn't really add up because, those appearances were, when I mean appear, I mean, show up in court and argue a case. But those appearances had happened years before this shooting, right? So, I don't know. I mean, that's the official story. I'll leave it up to you to decide whether or not you think it's believable or not. But anyway, in response to at least the official narrative on this, Congress has passed this bill to protect judges, if this bill goes forward, it'll keep, the contact and address and personal information of federal judges, private, classified, I guess, if you want to use that term. That way, members of the public can't show up to a judge's house and, threaten them one way or another. frankly, I'm surprised that this wasn't already a law in the books. Just knowing what I know, you know, in recent history, maybe not too recent, but, you know, think about it through the, you know, the 80s and the 90s during the, when they were prosecuting the mafia in mass with under the RICO statute. I would hope that at that point in time, they took measures to protect the personal, you know, private information of members of the judiciary. But it just kind of shocks me that this wasn't already the case, right? So the reason this got blocked apparently 7 months ago was that Senator Rand Paul, who I'm, you know, full disclosure, a pretty big fan of, he wanted the bill to include members of Congress as well. And if you know anything about Rand Paul, he was, apparently he got into some kind of fight with his neighbor a few years back, and he got really, like, messed up by this fight, man. Like, I remember he had bruises, he might have broken a couple bones. So you can understand why he might want to keep, you know, his own information kind of private. And not to mention, there was also that incident a few years back where that individual who was some kind of Bernie Sanders supporter went to the congressional baseball game practice and, you know, took shots at members of Congress. I mean, luckily, they all survived, and I can't remember if that guy got caught or, you know, the shooter, if he got caught or if he got killed. But, yeah, so that's why it didn't pass already. Interestingly enough, you have a bipartisan coalition promoting this. You got Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, John Kennedy of Louisiana, in the Senate at least, and you have Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, Senator Menendez here in New Jersey, Cory Booker, Mickey Sherrill in Congressional District 11. Bipartisan support for this. So, you know, I can't disagree. I think it's a good thing to kind of keep federal judges, you know, at least those involved in criminal trials, to keep their information secret. You know, my mind kind of brings me to El Chapo. He was the head of the Sinaloa drug cartel in his trial, I think, about a year or two ago. And, of course, this, if you know anything about the drug cartels in Mexico and most of, you know, Latin and South and Central America, they are, they don't mess around, man. They really don't. I remember reading stories about them, you know, assassinating judges, elected officials, police officers. They don't care. Effectively, Mexico's, you know, a narco state, at least in my opinion. And it doesn't really seem like the government there has a, you know, has a handle on this. You know, I've seen things in my own research about the cartels, like, you know, they buy like Ford F-150s, well, larger trucks, like F-350s, GMC 2500, Sierras, larger stuff like that, and they'll trick these things out with armor. I'm not even kidding. Like, they'll take, you know, steel plates and they'll, you know, they're welded to the outside of these trucks, and they're making what are effectively, you know, APCs and tanks. The cartels are nothing to mess around with, man. So, I mean, you think about that and the idea that they charged El Chapo in the United States, and, you know, obviously he faced trial in, you know, with a U.S., you know, a federal district court judge presiding. I hope his information was private at the time, but, I mean, who knows? So, yeah, hopefully this bill goes through. They'll protect these judges and, you know, other elected officials as well. All right, with that, folks, we're going to take a couple-minute break. We'll come back with some sports stories, some stuff about New Jersey, you know, some interesting things. So I'll shut up and enjoy the commercials.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325.
A college education, you don't have to go into debt before you even begin.
The actual price of a college education today could cost more than $200,000. Even if you don't qualify for financial need-based assistance, Premier College Funding can help you and your family cut college costs and find efficient ways to pay for college.
Call 908-788-3799 for a free consultation or visit us online at premiercollegefundingllc.com. Getting a college degree doesn't have to break the bank.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good morning, Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HunterdonChamberRadio.com.
All right. Welcome back, folks. It's Chris Sobieski coming to you live from the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce radio station right here in beautiful Flemington, New Jersey. It's hot as heck outside. My laptop's telling me it's 86. It feels more like 95 to 100. I went over this at the beginning of the show, but it's hot out there, folks. Drink your water. Stay hydrated. Stay cool. All right, so we're in the second portion of the show here. It's 3:26 p.m. I got a few sports stories, actually, for you. Now, full disclosure, I'm not the biggest sports fan. Growing up, I always had a sour taste in my mouth for pretty much all athletics after second grade, and I'll tell you why. I had joined the local, soccer league, right? For whatever reason, I wanted to get into soccer at that point in my life, 7 years old. You know, you make poor decisions when you're young, I guess. So, I joined the local soccer league, and my team didn't win a single game all season. We lost literally every single game, and I'm a very competitive person at the end of the day. So I was heartbroken after every time. I remember crying a couple times, actually, even though I played goalie. And I wasn't goalie. I was, what's the position? Not goalie. It's the other one who's like on the outside of that other goal. Sweeper? Something like that. I don't know. I don't know soccer. But ever since then, I've hated sports. Enough of my tangent, though. Let's get to the story here. So this is an interesting little wrinkle here. So former Seton Hall star Miles Powell is suing Coach Kevin Willard, and he's suing Seton Hall. Now, full disclosure, I'm a Seton Hall University graduate, both of, undergrad. I got my history degree there, and I graduated Seton Hall Law School last year. So I figured I'd bring this up because, it's close to home. It's a New Jersey story. Seton Hall is one of our, greatest schools in the state. Again, I'm a little bit biased in that regard, but besides the point. So here's a little bit of the story from the New York Post. Former Seton Hall basketball star Miles Powell is accusing head coach Kevin Willard, the team's medical expert, and the university of downplaying a serious knee injury that he says derailed his professional career. In the second game of the 2019 to 2020 season, Powell, then a senior, suffered an injury, and he was told by the coach and the university sports medicine director that he suffered an ankle injury and would be able to continue to play without any trouble. Well, it turns out that this was more than just a sprain, folks. It ended up being a torn meniscus, which is, I guess, far more severe than just a simple sprain. But yet, despite that, Miles continued to play on that leg, and he's alleging that this led to him, missing out on a professional career because of the damage that had been done to his leg. Now, the article isn't really specific on whether or not, NBA scouts might have required some kind of medical documentation before making him any offers. I really don't know how that whole process works, so part of my ignorance on the subject. But from a legal perspective, I thought this was pretty interesting, right? Now, this isn't your typical, doctor-patient malpractice sort of situation, right? Like, if it was Miles Powell and his doctor was the one who said, oh, yeah, no, you just got a simple sprain, don't worry about it, go on and play, he'd have a pretty significant case. But now he's alleging that because I don't think that kind of similar relationship applies to a coach or a university, sports medicine person, right?
So legally speaking, I haven't seen the brief, but I'm interested in what kind of arguments he'll be making. I'm assuming he's alleging some kind of, you know, monetary damages. And, yeah, it's an interesting story. Who knows if this is actually going to pan out in anything. But I'll give you some more details from the article itself here. So, okay, this is a little bit of information from the suit. So the suit claims that the untreated torn meniscus prevented Powell from being a lottery pick in the 2020 NBA draft. Powell, who went undrafted, was never considered to be a high draft pick, and most prognosticators projected him to go undrafted because of his 6'2" frame, which is small by NBA standards. Wow, I'm 6'0", and that kind of makes me pretty sad that I'm not tall enough. And so anyway, the 24-year-old, he ended up signing a contract with the Knicks for a guaranteed $50,000. Lottery picks can make up to $18 million, yada, 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 yada. He was waived by the organization in April, so I guess that even the Knicks canned him back in a couple months ago. So yeah, I guess Miles is, I guess his argument's going to focus on the idea that he, and again, this isn't exactly what it said. But I guess he's going to argue that because he was misdiagnosed by the coach and the you know, the sports medicine staff, and and by extension the university, that he wasn't able to address that injury in the correct manner, probably doing more damage to it by continuing to play, and because of the damage that was done, he wasn't able to perform up to snuff when it came time to try out for the draft. So I don't know, man. It's an interesting story. I mean, look, if they knew that he really had a torn meniscus, and this wasn't just a minor little sprain, I mean, you can't help but, you feel for the kid. He's probably spent his whole life playing basketball, working his way up to this level that he'd even be able to, even be a, like a bench player for the Knicks, right? And his whole, potentially his whole career is just completely shot because maybe of a mischaracterization of an injury. So we of course wish Mr. Powell the best. He made Seton Hall proud. I know the school won a few not full blown championships, but conference championships with him at the helm of the team. So yeah, we wish him all the best, and hope things work out for both parties, not just him, but the school. And it's really a shame when these kind of things happen, because it's tough seeing things you like and appreciate, like butt heads, like Seton Hall is, obviously where I went to college, and I love the place, and, I wouldn't be the man I am today without it. But at the same time, you can't help but, feel sympathetic towards a fellow student who, did what he needed to do, what was asked of him by the school. And, yeah, so good luck, Miles Powell. All right, so let's move on to another sports-related story here. So this has to deal with Sha'Carri Richardson, who you may know as the Olympic athlete who was, I shouldn't say Olympic athlete, the almost Olympic athlete who was not able to play in, not able to compete in the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games that are coming up in a couple weeks. Apparently, she failed a marijuana drug test. She'd been, allegedly smoking the ganj, and when it came time to take the test for the Olympics, she ended up failing for that reason, and because of that she was banned from the team and isn't able to compete. So kind of some good news for her, I guess. She was offered a $250,000 not a sponsorship, but a ambassadorship by this vaping company. I guess they make vape pens, and if you're not familiar, there's the technology surrounding marijuana has gotten pretty pretty wild over the past few years. So these vape pens, right? You're probably familiar with e-cigarettes, like Juuls and stuff. You get a little, it's essentially a battery powered device, right? And you put a cartridge on the device, and you hit the button on the device, and it heats up the cartridge, thus releasing vapor into your lungs as you inhale, right? So they do this with marijuana extract. It's not hash, it's something similar to that. But anyway, so Sha'Carri was offered this this deal where she would get, I think, $250,000 to be the face of this marijuana vape company. So, hey, she might not go to the Olympics, but at least she's getting, you know, she's getting the ability to financially support herself. And, you know, in the long run, that might kind of be best for her, you know, throughout the rest of her life. She, you know, she might be able to monetize this. I mean, I'm sure, like, you know, being able to compete in the Olympic Games is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But it isn't a guaranteed payday, right? And I know actually a lot of Olympic athletes really aren't that wealthy. I mean, of course, you get the big names. You get the big sponsorship deals and stuff. Like, you know, I think of Bruce / Caitlyn Jenner, who back in the day was, you know, the face of Wheaties and all these other things at the time. Michael Phelps, of course, is another one. Another stoner, too, by the way. I know Michael Phelps got in trouble for smoking pot a few years back. You know, very interesting how these guys are, why there's such a stigma around marijuana when you think about it at the end of the day. Like, and I'm not a big, like, you know, gung-ho, like, I'm not a pro-drug person per se, you know, but you compare marijuana to like alcohol, for example, and alcohol is far more dangerous, right? Like, you're literally poisoning yourself when you drink it. Now, that doesn't stop me from having a beer every once in a while or a nice Jack and Coke. But look, it's not good for you. You know, we can acknowledge it's good for you. And, you know, maybe smoking marijuana isn't necessarily good for you either. But look, you know, if we're going to say that alcohol is totally, you know, socially acceptable, despite the damage that it does, not just to, you know, your own body, but it, you know, causes you to act, well, certain people to act very, you know, aggressively and violently and, you know, make very poor, very, very poor decisions, and significantly, you know, of course, in excess, significantly inhibits your ability to function and your motor skills, yada, yada, yada. You catch my drift. So it's just odd that, you know, Olympic athletes won't get in trouble for drinking, at least to my knowledge, but they will for, you know, smoking some tree every once in a while. I don't know. And then you combine that with the fact that you have, I think, the first transgender male to female athlete competing in the women's powerlifting competition this year. I can't remember this individual's name, but I know they come from New Zealand, I'm pretty sure. And this was a person who was, you know, is still a biological male, but you know, went through this transition process a few years back and now is competing as a female. So I don't know, it just seems kind of odd from a 30,000 foot view. And let me be perfectly clear, I have no problem or, you know, issue or, you know, have any ill will towards people who are, you know, the transgender persuasion. You know, I'm a very live and let live type of guy, but it just seems kind of odd that you can compete in the women's Olympic Games if you are a biological male, but you can't compete in the women's Olympic Games if you smoke marijuana. I don't know. It seems a little odd to me, but what do I know? Well, we wish, in any case, we wish Sha'Carri Richardson the best. Oh, by the way, the company that she's being getting this offer from is called Dr. Dabber. So, yeah, we'll leave it at that. Okay, speaking of marijuana, we're going to take it a little more locally here. Flemington, the town that I'm sitting in right now, they just gave the okay, sort of, well, some nuance to this. They are on the course of saying okay to a... oh, no, they did approve the ordinance. All right, so they have said okay to allowing, you know, marijuana-based businesses in the town, in Flemington here, right? So a little bit of backstory. Last year, there was a ballot measure that we, you know, all New Jersey voters got to vote on that basically asked the question whether or not you wanted, you know, to amend the Constitution to allow for, you know, legalized sale, possession, etc. of marijuana. And I believe the vote in total, the percentage was about 66, roughly, percent voted yes on that question. So that's it's close to like two-thirds of the state said yes to this, right? And, you know, I'll give you a little more background, some inside baseball, me being a, you know, municipal official in East Amwell. A lot of municipalities were really interested in the idea of allowing dispensaries to open within their borders when this first got brought up, actually a few years back. And for the reason being that you would be able to, as a municipality, drop or enact an additional 2% tax on top of, you know, the normal property tax or operational taxes that accompany, you know, commercial enterprises in their borders, right? So that being said, you know, the marijuana industry is booming. It's very popular. I mean, you go out to Colorado, you got to California, there's dispensaries all over the place. There's a lot of people moving into those areas for that reason. So this seemed like a very, you know, it still seems, at least in my opinion, to be a good way for municipalities to bring in some additional revenue without necessarily having to lay a direct tax on their constituents, right? Like, we have one of the highest, if not the highest, property taxes in the country. So, you know, at least in my mind and in the mind of many other elected officials throughout the state, you know, they're seriously considering allowing for, you know, these marijuana-related businesses within their borders, you know, for the simple reason that, you know, it's a, from a fiscal perspective, it just makes a whole lot of sense. Now, of course, there's the stigma that comes along with, you know, having a dispensary and, you know, the idea of whether or not you're supporting, you know, what would some people would call drug abuse. I don't consider marijuana to be a drug per se in the traditional understanding of the word, but, you know, everyone has their opinion, and of course they're entitled to it. It's a free country, and, you know, having this debate I think is healthy at the end of the day. But getting back to Flemington here, so according to this article from Tap Into Flemington, written by Liz Johnson, shout out to her, thanks for putting this together. The Flemington Borough Council took its first steps to allow cannabis retailers and cultivators in the borough, unanimously approving an ordinance Monday that would limit each to 2 licenses for a total of 4 licenses allowed for such businesses. So retailers, that's going to be, you know, your dispensaries. They're going to be able to operate in the downtown business, downtown 2 business, and transition commercial, highway retail, and artisan village shopping districts. Oh, those are all zoning districts in Flemington. It can only operate between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. Cultivators, that's, you know, I'm assuming that's your grow operations. They're going to be able to operate in areas zoned for professional office, community business, downtown 2 business, and the village artisan shopping and highway retail districts. So Flemington's already getting, you know, they want to be first in line to allow dispensaries to open up within their borders, which is great for them. And, you know, I wish them the best in doing this. Now, the only problem, and this is what's kind of holding us up, at least in my town in East Amwell, is that the state was supposed to release a certain set of regulations that are kind of going to color in a lot of the gaps that came off of the law they passed a few months back, you know, allowing for this in the first place, right? So a lot of municipalities have so far voted not to allow marijuana, not necessarily because they don't want to, but because the regulations haven't come out, right? And I, you know, we actually did that in East Amwell, but we're, you know, we're still open to the idea of opening it up, and, you know, I hope we do move forward with that. But the reason being is that we don't have, you know, the regulations in front of us. We don't know if this is going to be a good thing or a bad thing, what kind of costs, you know, what might pop up later down the road that we're not aware of, right? So a lot of them are waiting, and I think, I believe August 21st is the deadline for the state to, you know, release these regulations. So, you know, I guess this is a word of, not necessarily of warning, but, you know, for your information, you might see that your town has, you know, voted to, you know, to opt out of allowing marijuana in its borders. You might see that they passed an ordinance doing that. But, you know, be wary that in the future, maybe a couple months down the road, they might pass a completely different ordinance allowing for it, for the simple reason that, you know, they don't have the regs in front of them right now, and they might show up later. So, it's a very interesting, you know, prospect, I think, financially. You know, just for example, in East Amwell, we have an operating budget, I believe it's around like $3.5 million, give or take a few $100,000. And we were estimating on the high end that if we were to allow a single dispensary in the municipality, we could bring in as much as $1.5 million in additional revenue. So that's what, about a little more than a third? Yeah, it's about a little more than a third of what, you know, our total operating budget is. And, you know, with that additional revenue coming in, we could cut taxes. We could pay for a lot of other, you know, great community events. You know, we're trying to work on fixing up Ringo's, which is the downtown area of the township. So that additional money would go a very long way, especially in small towns, right? So, you know, let's hope the state comes back with some good regs. You know, good luck to Flemington for being the first to do this sort of thing. You know, we wish them all the best. But, yeah, so it's 3:44, and we're going to take another couple-minute break here. I'll be back in a few minutes, so, enjoy the commercials.
Hi. I help students gain admission to colleges that are a great academic, social, and financial fit, where they will be successful, happy, and graduate on time with minimal debt. Email Diana at creativecollegeconsulting.com for a free consultation.
Hey, Pat. You know, between the two of us, we know how to screw in a light bulb.
Come on, Steve. We can do better than that. Well, at least I can. Tell you what, you sit there and look pretty, and I'll fix it.
Listen to you, big guy. Better yet, let's get everyone to listen to Home Sweet Home with me, Steve Bailey, Inspector with Brass Tack Home Inspections.
And I'm Pat Gregory, Handyman Extraordinaire with Taskman Home Improvements, every Friday at 11 a.m. Or you can go to our archives and get access to over 50 podcasts. We cover the basement to the attic and everything in between.
You can even call us at 908-237-0410 during our radio program about our home improvement projects. Remember, Home Sweet Home, every Friday at 11 on Hunterton Chamber Radio.
From the basement to the attic, you're listening to Steve and Patrick. Home Sweet Home.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterton is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
Welcome back, folks. This is Chris Sobieski coming to you live from Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce radio station right here in beautiful Flemington, New Jersey. The time is 3:47 p.m. We're in the last leg of the show here, but I do have a couple more stories I want to bring to you. Things I'd like to opine on a little bit and put out into the public consciousness if they aren't there already. So before I get to that, though, I got to remind you this is supposed to be the Location, Location, Location show with Jeannie, Larry, and myself, Chris. Unfortunately, Larry and Jeannie are out today. They're very busy as of late. Larry's, of course, a home inspector. And his business has been very busy with us coming out of the lockdowns and the real estate market really picking up. Jeannie's also a real estate agent, so she's busy as heck selling houses right now. Me, on the other hand, I'm still searching for my full-time lawyer job, so I got a little time on my hands to come in and fill in for them. So I'm not complaining. Anyway, let's get to the last couple stories of the day here before I let you guys go. This is coming to us from Blaze Media. This is a story that really kind of really scared me earlier in the week, and I should have brought this up earlier in the day, earlier in the broadcast, because it's very important, and it's the implications of this are very serious. But I wanted to get to it nonetheless. So this is coming to us from the Blaze Media, the Blaze.com headline: Democrats are pressuring companies to censor text messages about Biden's pandemic response. And I'll just read you a little bit of the article here. So the Biden administration is taking more aggressive actions against what they consider to be, quote, disinformation from critics on their right, according to a political report. Left-wing groups, including the Democrat National Committee, are also planning to engage fact-checkers to fight back against dissenting voices, yada, 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 yada. I'll get to the real interesting part. The allegation here is that the White House wants private phone companies like Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, etc., to in real time censor text messages that you send between, that people send to each other, really, right? Sorry, a little problem with the audio there. Yeah, so the allegation here is that the White House is trying to encourage phone companies to censor, you know, what they call misinformation regarding things of the vaccine. I know there's a better article on this than The Blaze, at least given some more details on what this proposal is. But this, the core tenet here is that, you know, the White House wants, you know, let's say Verizon. I'm just going to kind of speak in hypothetical here. They want Verizon to, you know, let's say theoretically I send a text to, you know, my mom saying that, you know, and this isn't necessarily how I feel, but, you know, let's say I send to her, oh, I heard the vaccines will give you cancer, something crazy like that. We all know that isn't true. Well, as of right now, we know that isn't, you know, that isn't the case. But, you know, let's say I send that to my mom. I guess what the White House wants is for, you know, maybe some kind of fact check to show up on that text message, or maybe the text just won't send at all. I think we need some more details on what this actually entails, but this is, you know, if this is the case, folks, this is very terrifying, right? You know, because it's not just going to stop at vaccine, you know, quote-unquote misinformation. And you might think to yourself, hey, you know, it's very dangerous for people to be spreading rumors about public health emergencies. You don't want people thinking things that aren't true. And I get that. But we have what's called the Constitution. We have a First Amendment right to freedom of speech, and that means the freedom to be stupid or wrong or whatever you want to call it, right? So, and it's a very slippery slope, right? Like, the more you power you give to the government, rarely does it ever go away, right? Like, let's think back throughout history, right? When the country first really got going after the, you know, the Constitution was adopted by all the various states, you had a much weaker federal government, right? Like, you didn't even have a Secret Service at that point in time. You had, you know, a standing military, and of course there was a, you know, a branch of the government that was there to enact taxes, but you didn't have, you know, the NSA, you didn't have the, you know, the USDA, you didn't have the, you know, the EPA, all the, you know, the ATF, the CIA, you didn't have all these massive federal bureaucratic agencies. And, you know, now some of them might have, you know, at certain points in time fallen by the wayside, but really it was just that they were renamed into something else. Like, for example, in World War II, we had the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, I think that's what the OSS stands for. And that ultimately got kind of turned into the CIA. And, yeah. So once you open the government Pandora box, you can't put it back in, folks. And, you know, extrapolate that to this text message stuff. Even if you think, okay, yeah, we need to stop, you know, text people from sending misinformation to each other about the vaccines. Now, what happens when it comes to, you know, whether or not people agree with the results of a particular election or really anything else? I mean, my God, they could censor any kind of story they wanted to with this kind of power, right? I mean, this is, I know people like to turn, like throw the word socialism out there a lot and communism without really understanding what they mean. But this is like just straight up authoritarianism. I don't know how else you're going to slice it. We have the state coming in and effectively regulating the communication of individuals amongst each other, right? And you might say, oh, well, if it's a private business doing it, yeah, but if the federal government's forcing them to, it's not really just a private business doing it on their own. So I'm praying to God that this doesn't actually end up happening, but if it does, folks, I mean, we're in a very, very scary place in history. You know, like, this is not what the country was founded on. You know, sorry if I'm getting political here, but my God, this is just sick. Look, you know, I'm going to give the Biden administration the benefit of the doubt here, because they're saying, oh, you know, you're overthinking it, and we're not really doing that. But, you know, if there's one thing I know from working in politics for the past few years, it's that, look, everybody's got an agenda at the end of the day, and they're not necessarily telling you the full truth. They might give you, you know, what they might say might be accurate, but, you know, it might be missing context, and, you know, it's deceptive by, what's it called, the lie by omission. So, I don't know. We'll keep monitoring it. We'll see what happens. Let's hope it doesn't. Okay, so 3:54 is the time. I got time for one more story, and this is a follow-up to something I brought up last week, something a little more bright and sunny compared to the idea of government censorship of private text messages. So this, we're going back to the Swan down in South Jersey, and this is in Ocean County. I think I brought the story up last week. And at that point in time, there was an issue with a swan in a pond in Brick Township, and he had been effectively been given the death, was ordered to be given the death penalty. They were going to euthanize the swan because he was being very aggressive, I as I understand it, he had this one was protecting a bunch of his, you know, his offspring that were, you know, they're his kids, and they're all swimming around in this little pond down there in Brick. And anytime people would get close to the swans, he would start attacking them. It's kind of funny. But it turns out that he's actually a mute swan, and that's an invasive species, according to the State Wildlife Agency. And because of that reason, they couldn't like relocate him. Right? They were just gonna kill him. You know, for lack of a better word, that's what they were gonna do: euthanize, whatever you want to call it. They were gonna kill the thing. But we have a what might be a positive development, and I'm hoping that's what this is. Apparently the swan inadvertently saved himself, and this is coming from an article from NJ.com, again, posted on July 10th, so a few days ago. So apparently what happened was that at a certain park, a guy was fishing, right? And the swan got wrapped up in the fishing line. It's the same swan, mind you. And he was taken to an animal rescue. So he's no longer like a threat to the community, I guess, if you could ever even call him that. And now he's at this rescue, and it's kind of up in the air what they're going to do with him. I'm praying to God that they can actually, you know, find a way to, you know, maybe transport him and his family somewhere else where they're not going to be a problem to the neighbors. Just to give you an idea of how big this is kind of ballooned into. The mayor of Brick is involved in this. People are calling their congressmen in the area to try to step in and help the swan out. You've got state assemblymen, state senator Jim Holzapfel. God, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And assemblymen Greg McGuckin and John Catalano. And they're all involved in this, trying to save this swan. It's just such a goofy story, man. Yeah, so they named the swan Alfie, too, by the way. So Alfie the swan has been, as for now, spared the needle. So we'll say a prayer for Alfie. Hope my boy makes it out. Good luck to him, and good luck to the people of Brick Township in dealing with this problem. So, yeah, I guess that's it for the day, guys. Look, it's about 3:57 right now. I'm going to wrap up the show. I appreciate all of you tuning in. It's going to probably be like this for the next few weeks, where it's just me kind of sitting in, bringing you guys some interesting news stories, giving you a little bit of context, a little bit of perspective from somebody who's, you know, I guess probably a little bit younger than most people that listen to this station. I'm going to be 28 in about a couple weeks, so, you know, should be a fun few weeks ahead of us, folks. So, look, I appreciate you guys tuning in. This was Chris Sobieski filling in for Jeannie and Larry by myself on the Location show here at the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce radio station. I appreciate all of you tuning in. Have yourselves a beautiful weekend, beautiful rest of your day. And I'll talk to you guys next week. Thank you very much.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Help make your community safer. Hunterdon County Crime Stoppers is a community-based program aimed at making our community safer by providing an avenue for citizens to anonymously report criminal activity. It provides monetary rewards if the information leads to an arrest and indictment. See something, say something, and get cash for your anonymous tip. Call or text 1-800-321-0010 or go online to www.crimestoppershunterdon.com.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our Restaurant Showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location, Next Level Arena on Case Boulevard in Flemington from 2 to 7 p.m. If you're a business or organization and would like to participate, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or visit our website at 100andchamber.org.
Hi, I help students gain admission to colleges that are a great academic, social, and financial fit, where they will be successful, happy, and graduate on time with minimal debt. Email Diana at
creativecollegeconsulting.com. Sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Ready to help you put a confident retirement more within your reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton, Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you achieve your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. That's 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC.
USA Radio News. I'm Ron Taylor. Health officials say Americans are overreacting to the threat of Ebola. On CNN's State of the Union, CDC Director Dr. Thomas Frieden noted that only one confirmed case of the disease has been diagnosed in the entire country. More than 3,000 people in West Africa have died of Ebola. Meanwhile, an American news photographer suffering from Ebola is due to arrive in Omaha early this morning. Dr. Phil Smith at Nebraska Medical Center says they are ready for the arrival of Ashoka Mupo.
When he's in flight and when he lands, we have team members that will help facilitate the transfer, and they will radio ahead and tell us what the situation is. They're going to go in that room and they're going to try to quell his fears, and we'll apply the most advanced medicine we can.
Dr. Phil Smith at Nebraska Medical Center says they will receive updates on Ashoka Mupo's condition. This is USA Radio News.
And now another Staples business tip. Upgrading everyone's technology can make your business more productive.
Hey, Phil, can you wrap it up? I need to use the laptop there.
You got it, Frank.
Hey, I called dibs on the laptop.
Excuse me, I put my request in yesterday.
Too bad.
My title is CFO, which stands for Computer Frank Only.
Phil, you are a...
Make that a lot more productive.
Now get free shipping and up to 5% back in rewards when you sign up for Staples Rewards. Staples, make more happen every day.
It's time to earn your MBA at DeVry University's Keller Graduate School of Management. Keller professors share real-world experience so students graduate ready to advance in their careers. Get started with our merit-based Career Catalyst Scholarship with up to $8,000 for new students who qualify. Classes start October 27th. Full details at keller.edu/scholarships. For students who qualify and start by November 2014, subject to approval and availability of funds, DeVry University is authorized for operation by the TAGC, certified to operate by SHED. In New York, DeVry University operates as DeVry College of New York.
Two different aspects of the economy were the focus of the President and Republicans' weekly radio addresses. Your senior correspondent, Jason Wirt.
President Obama delivered his weekly radio address from a factory in Indiana where a town hall meeting was scheduled with steelworkers. The president gave a little praise to the American worker for economic recovery and a lot of credit to himself and his administration.
It's a direct result of the American people's drive and determination and the decisions made by my administration. During the last decade, people thought the decline in American manufacturing was inevitable. But we chose to invest in the American auto industry and in American workers. Today, an auto industry that was flatlining 6 years ago is building and selling new cars at the fastest pace in 8 years.
The Republican response from House candidate Elise Stefanik included talking about the damage that Obamacare has done to small business in America.
Because of Obamacare, my family's small business had our coverage canceled.